It's Monday, the 24th of June. Alan Chartok on the line with the governor of New York State, Andrew Cuomo. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning, Ian. Good morning, doctor.
So it sounds like Ian, but it's actually Joe. I wanted you to know that because, you know, they sound exactly alike and they look exactly alike, but that's the difference.
One, I'm sorry, course, Joe. No disrespect.
One, of course, is 6'7", and the other is much less. And there you go. Anyway, thank you, Joe. Appreciate it. Okay, Governor, I have a couple of questions for you. First of all, you know, the press keeps making a sort of a contest between you and the legislative leaders. In other words, winners and losers. The press are suggesting that you were kept out of a good deal of the decision-making and therefore you have lost your power. Is that true?
First, good morning to you. One quick question for you. Are you at 100% capacity, or should this be a muted dialogue due to your diminished capacity?
Well, you know, the thing is, if you've ever had, you know, if you ever had a concussion, you're never quite right. There is no question about it. And I just want you to be charitable towards me.
Okay, I will be charitable. The press says a lot of things because they need to sell a newspaper. So we understand that. So let's talk facts. Look at this legislative agenda and what was passed from the budget forward, right? Most of the work was done in the budget in April. This has been the most robust agenda that has been passed by the state. Virtually all of the issues that were passed, I had previously proposed, and in past years worked for most of them and failed with the Republican Senate. So if you had a factual look at it, you would say, well, Cuomo proposed all these things back in December and fought for them, many of these issues, for many years. Dream Act, he fought for many years. Rent reform, he fought for many years and accomplished as much as he could with the Republican Senate. So there's literally everything they passed is something that I supported and I had proposed first. Also, I can't pass a bill, and they can't pass a bill. I have to sign the bill. So when you say, well, your piece, well, he's going to take credit. I get the credit or the blame. If I sign the bill, I get credit. If I sign the bill and people don't like it, I get the blame, right? I'm the one signature that is required. So that's just the constitution of things, right?
Right. But do you negotiate with them at all? Apparently not, right? I'm hearing that you're not in, it's not the three men in the room, although our Blair Horner, our commentator, says, and your former employee, says that it is still three men in a room or three people in a room because you certainly have Andrea Stewart Cousins.
Well, this legislature is different than previous legislatures, right? It was the first time Democrats were in power. This was largely a political dynamic this year, driven by the Trump presidency, and the Trump election drove many of these people to be elected to office themselves, right? The last statewide elections that elected these assembly people and senators was basically an anti-Trump agenda, right? So they came with a very political agenda. Many of them did not have any experience in government. They were driven by advocacy groups and advocacy proposals, many of which they just took and put into bill language and passed as legislation. We then obviously were involved because we had to make sure the legislation actually made sense and that good intentions also translated to good effect. So you look at what was proposed by the legislative houses and what was actually passed, you'll see a very big difference. And there, Blair is right. The rent bill they passed, we had to fix in the final bill. because it would have destroyed our affordable housing program and restabilized hundreds of thousands of units, which they didn't intend to. The DREAM Act bill had errors in it that we had to correct, and on and on. So that is the yin and the yang, right? They wanted to pass proposals that made the advocacy groups happy. We actually had to make sure those proposals worked because this is a complex system. And you put your finger in the middle of it and you just stir it around. Sometimes that helps, sometimes it hurts. But I think we managed that. You know, you had a tremendous infusion of political energy into the system, not just in New York, all across the nation. The trick is how to make that positive infusion of energy a positive. And if you look at the bills that were actually passed, you'll see that we had a major impact on most of them. Solitary rent, marijuana, when legalization didn't work, I suggested we go to decriminalization. So it was a joint process, certainly.
Okay. I want to ask you about the green light bill, which allows undocumented immigrants to, you know, apply for a driver's license. If county clerks won't comply, and there are some who say they won't, will you remove them from office? Is that a possibility?
That is going to go, when I say political issues, that issue, driver's license, is going to go immediately to court. And that will subsume everything. There are already threatened lawsuits by counties and county clerks, and that issue will have to be litigated because it is going to be a not just politically controversial, but a legally difficult issue. The question would be if you have undocumented people sign up on the DMV database and the federal government sends a subpoena saying we want the DMV database for law enforcement purposes, can we hold it from them or can they use it to actually find and deport people?
Right.
And that question is going to have to be settled in courts. And my guess is it runs right into next year's election, presidential election, which is going to be about immigration, right? Driver's licenses for undocumented is a proxy for the immigration debate. And you already see Trump saying this is going to be about immigration, right? He was going to deport millions of people. And now he says, well, he'll wait to see what Congress does. My guess is Congress doesn't do anything that he likes. And then he can say, well, I waited. And it's all about immigration. And the undocumented license is just a proxy for that. So it's going to wind up right in the courts.
So let me go on to marijuana. It was a disappointment. A lot of people wanted it. In my great state of Massachusetts, we have it. That all the tax revenues that are coming from it are coming to my town of Great Barrington, where the lines are around the block. And a lot of people in New York are a little, and a lot of New York license plates, by the way, on the lines. So my question to you is, what about a statewide referendum? You know, let everybody vote.
Everything is great in Massachusetts, according to you, Doctor.
Well, it's true.
State of Massachusetts, Great Barrington, everything is great. Why don't you say great state of New York, just for equity? Could you do that for me, just as a
sure,
protocol?
The great state of, okay. I'll say it right now, the great state of New York.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Uh-huh.
Hollow gesture on your part.
It is hollow.
Yeah, legalization, I supported. I thought we were going to get there this year. I believe if we had done it as part of the budget in April, we would have gotten there. And I think it was a mistake when it was taken out of the budget, as I've said on your show 15 times.
Yep.
And I think it was shocking to the legislature that they didn't have the votes to pass it. Decriminalization was fallback plan B. Ian asked me about it on the show. He said, well, why don't you go to decriminalization if legalization isn't going to pass? I said, well, that's plan B, and we don't go there until the 20th hour of the 24-hour session. And when it became clear, then we went to decriminalization. You could have also done a referendum. It would pass the referendum as a sense of the people. You can't do a referendum to make it law,
no.
But you could have done a referendum as a sense of the people. And I believe they knew that it was statewide popular. But it is controversial. You know, in this state, even if something is 60-40, Alan, the 40% can be intense. Gun control is 60-40. But those 40 really got annoyed with me when I passed gun safety measures. The woman's right to choose can be 60-40, but those 40 feel it very passionately. Marijuana is one of those issues. Maybe it's 55, let's say. But the opposition is really adamant and annoyed, and the legislators are saying, I don't want to alienate 45% of the people in my district. Thank you very much.
Or even in some districts, 55% of the people.
Yes. Right. Yes, right. You know, you have to remember, and there are two ends of the equation. One of the articles I was reading today only mentions one aspect of it. First, this state has different politics in different regions. Long Island is different than New York City, is different than Western New York. Yes, Democrats, blue state. Baloney, it's shades of blue. And you have more liberal, more conservative, and more moderate Democrats in different parts of the state. And those legislators have to represent their district or they're no longer legislators. And many of these issues have very different constituencies and rates of opposition across the state. So that's a tension. You then have a dual political tension. New York City Democrats afraid of a primary from the left. And some other legislators from other parts of the state afraid of a primary from the left, the way the moderate Republicans always fear an extreme right. That's one tension. And then you have the marginal members who are also afraid of an attack from the right, from the Republicans. So in those out of New York City areas, they have a dual tension. They're afraid of getting hit from the left, and they're afraid of getting hit from the right. So they are in a precarious political position. New York City, you're never going to lose a general election in New York City. Or if you do, you really deserve to. So they're only afraid about an attack from the left. And that's what you see play out through the legislative session.
Let me ask you about Israel. Are you going to Israel?
Wednesday.
And what do you hope to accomplish there? And why are you going? Is it a political thing? Is it to shore up, you know, people in the Jewish groups who maybe need this from you? Or is it that's my question. What's your motivation?
First, we have important state business. I've gone to Israel a number of times. Israel is a very important trade partner for us. We're going to go to Israel and do a trade mission, basically talking to businesses that are there, specifically on our economic development agenda, drone technology, which we're investing in very heavily, especially in central New York. We're also going to talk to software companies in Israel because they have some of the leading tech companies on the globe to see if they would be interested in helping the MTA developing a software product for the navigation system in the trains. I still don't understand why you have cars that can drive themselves, but we can't figure out how to have a train that doesn't hit the train in front of it. And getting those new tech companies to actually see the economic potential for them in an MTA contract. The MTA is spending billions of dollars on a navigation system. We're not asking for charity. Just saying, here's a business opportunity you may not have thought of. So that's the first point. And second, yes, I'm very close, and New Yorkers are very close to Israel. There's been a rash of anti-Semitism all across this country, the synagogue shootings, et cetera. We've had it in this state, all across this state, and it's repugnant to what New Yorkers believe and feel. And I hope there's a message of solidarity and partnership in my trip to Israel. And I hope the Jewish community here is confident in this state's position vis-a-vis Israel.
Now, I can't help but ask you about Netanyahu himself, who is obviously a close ally of the president. Does that give you any pause?
No. He's a close ally of the president. I think he's working with this president for his own interests, and they may have a coincidence of interests. But look, you can have political differences, and we can sit here and say we politically differ with Israel's policies on whatever issue. But how does that transfer into hate and anti-Semitism? I understand we have an overheated political environment in this country, but we also have a constitutional and legacy of accepting and living together and accepting diversity. And the Jewish community is an essential part of the state of New York. So you want to have a political difference with Israel, be my guest. But you have no right to turn that into anti-Semitism.
So I think, I hate to say this to you because you're so much smarter than I am, but, you know, for you to say that he's just working, Netanyahu and the president are just working together, there's a pretty special relationship that I see here, and it's troubling to me at least, and you don't have anything to say about that?
Well, first let me just start with the preface. You hate to disagree, I'm so smart. You called me something like infuriatingly smart in your column this week.
Yeah.
I've never heard the expression infuriatingly smart. I've heard infuriatingly ignorant, infuriatingly stubborn, infuriatingly narrow-minded, closed-minded. I've never heard infuriatingly smart. What does that mean?
Well, it means just what it says, you know, that you can take, your dad could do it too, black and turn it into white, white and turn it into black, because you're so smart. You're good with words, you're good with concepts, and therefore you are infuriatingly smart.
And why does that infuriate you? Why does intelligence infuriate you?
Well, no, it's not the intelligence that infuriates me. It's the outcome. In other words, you know, I know you're wrong, but you talk your way so well.
If I'm wrong, then how am I also smart? If I'm smart, wouldn't the premise be that I was right?
You see, there
and
you
maybe
go.
You're
again.
Wrong?
This is a perfect example of exactly what I'm talking about. You're picking on a poor guy with a concussion. You're saying...
Okay. I forgot the rules. You're right. I withdraw the question. I withdraw the comment. I take it all back.
See, even there. Okay, the New York Times editorialized the other day, there's hope for the subways, and noted that arrival times are at the best mark since 2013. Also noted that your relationship with Andy Byford and MTA Chairman Patrick Foy has been strained, and urged you to choose independent thinkers for the MTA board. What's your response?
My response is the New York Times is part right, part wrong, infuriatingly smart and infuriatingly incorrect. If we're staying with the concept of infuriating, the MTA has gotten better, but the progress and the lessons learned now have to be institutionalized, and that's the hardest part. I was watching a movie late last night where the person dies, and they take this big needle of adrenaline, I think, and they put it in the heart of the person, and they hit the needle, and the body comes back to life. Ooh. Yeah, good news is the body came back to life. That's what we did with the MTA. We took a 2017, the system was at an all-time low. We announced something called the Subway Action Plan, and we pumped $1 billion into the system. We brought in independent contractors, more workers, et cetera. I spent weeks, I think, walking around subway tunnels with fixing signals and cleaning drains. That was the adrenaline shot. We can't do that again. It's $1 billion a shot, and the body can't sustain multiple shots. It's not a way to live life. So we now have to institutionalize those changes. And really what we did over the past 2 years was we just compensated for a breakdown of management systems all across the board. Pat Foy has worked with me since I became governor. He was in the chamber, then the Port Authority. He's a very good man. I appointed him chairman of the MTA about 3 months ago. I think the Times is wrong to say Pat should be credited with the turnaround, because the turnaround was 2 years ago, Subway Action Plan. Pat's only been there 3 months. Joe Loda came up with the Subway Action Plan. I worked with him on it, but he worked on it, and a woman named Ronnie Hakem, who was the first female president of the MTA. And it's funny that the New York Times would leave out the first female president. So much for diversity and women equality and women first. But Loda and Ronnie really killed themselves with the Subway Action Plan for 2 years. Foy's a great guy, and he was there, but he only became chairman 3 months ago. So by definition, he couldn't have been doing the Subway Action Plan or responsible for it the way Loda was. But now we have to institutionalize it, and that's going to be the hardest challenge, because the $1 billion is over. The syringe is empty. Now you have to take those lessons and reorganize the entire organization, which has been dysfunctional. And that's a reorganization plan that the board has to come up with in the next 45 or 60 days. And that's going to be the real test of this next step. Can you institutionalize the lessons and the progress?
Okay. I want to ask you about tomorrow. It's primary day, right, in New York? The first time primaries are being held in June to align with future federal primaries. What are you watching for?
I'm just watching for turnout. When there is a very low turnout, weird things happen because there's a very low turnout. If there's a higher turnout, then more Democrats speak, and outcome tends to be more representative of the overall Democratic opinion. So it'll be turnout, and turnout is also important to see how engaged people still are. You know, as I like to say to you, because it's my retort to having to listen to you keep saying the great state of Massachusetts, I won by more votes than any governor in history, in both the primary and the general last year. Well, that must be my good looks, my wit, and my charm. All of those,
and
thank you for pointing that out, and because the turnout was so high. And the turnout was high because people were engaged. It was the litmus test of the political energy. I'd like to see in this primary, is the energy still that high, and are people still coming out, or has it subsided?
And so how important is the AOC phenomena? You know, here is somebody who has electrified many people, who is, obviously you're turning a lot of heads. You got Mike Gianaris, who is the number two in the state Senate, obviously, I think, worried about primaries and whether they'll do things. He's sticking right with her. So what is AOC? What has that meant in terms of the changes?
Yeah, it's a significant political point, but purely political, in that what they're afraid of, we talked about the New York City Dems, you mentioned Gianaris, they're afraid of a primary from the left and a low turnout election, the so-called Joe Crowley effect,
right,
where nobody votes, but a small base of motivated people does turn out and they lose. So there, some of them are tripping over themselves on the way to the left to appease this activist, younger demographic.
Do you think Mike Gianaris is one of them?
I think many of the New York City Democrats are afraid of the ultra-left, or a product of the ultra-left in the last primary. See, when you have a very low turnout primary, Joe Crowley... there was only, I want to say, she won with like 15,000 votes or something. I won that district against Cynthia Nixon by 37 points. How does Crowley lose and I win by 37 points? It's the turnout. So, yes, I think it has a political dynamic. I think there's a larger political debate to be had, what does it mean to be a progressive? And you can even look at this past agenda in this legislative session, which was, quote unquote, progressive. In many ways, I don't think it was progressive enough. What happened, doctor, to discussion of poverty and civil rights and the minority community? How did you have a discussion of criminal justice reform and not insist that you close Rikers Island, the worst jail in the United States of America, which we've been talking about closing for years, and nothing has happened? It's pure government apathy. But because they're minorities and they're in Rikers, they don't get the kind of government action. Why don't we really say we're going to fund poor public schools? Poor. Not fund all public schools, so we trickle down to the poor school, but take the political bull by the horns and say, no, the rich schools don't need more money. We're going to fund the poor schools. These kinds of issues.
Well, answer your own question. An aggressive progressive. Why don't you answer your own question? Why don't we do that?
I've been arguing about these issues for years. Politically, they're too difficult.
You're not going to tell the people in Scarsdale and other places that they can't have their money. Are you kidding?
Why not?
Because they won't like it.
Why not have the political courage to stand up and say to Scarsdale, look, you don't need the money as much as the South Bronx or rural communities in the state. I'm sorry. We are bringing equity to education.
You know, it's a fascinating question. It is a fascinating question. You know, of course, why not? We all know why not, because people are going to try to feather their own nests, and they're not going to want to pay more money. And the other thing that's so interesting is that the poor people don't have, even with numbers, don't have the clout that the richest do, right?
And yes, shame on you, progressive movement, that you came down to that, which is true, Alan, but shame on you. Shame on you for not taking on Rikers, because you're going to have to cite jails and outer boroughs, and it's politically inconvenient, and there is no constituency for the people in Rikers anyway. It's the worst jail. You want to talk about solitary confinement and abuse and assaults? It's called Rikers Island. Federal government came in years ago and said it violates people's civil rights. Education is the top issue for every politician. Just listen to them speak. Okay. So, will you stop funding Scarsdale and fund the South Bronx? Oh, no, no, no. That's too politically difficult, because every legislator wants to bring pork home to their own school district. You call yourself a progressive? No. Sometimes it takes courage. Don't tell me where you are on the easy ones. Tell me where you are on the hard ones. That's what we talk about at your eulogy. You did on the test of character.
And when we come back the next time, I'm going to start by asking you, how do you like living in the mansion? I wouldn't want to go live at 50 West 96th Street. That's for sure, where my parents lived and raised me. How about you?
That's a topic for next time. I got myself all fired up on that failings now.
That's the next time. Okay, Governor Andrew Cuomo, thank you. And we always appreciate your giving us this time. It's terrific.
Thank you,
thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thanks so much.